Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, hi, and welcome. I am your host, Emma Gunnar Wardner, and in my nearly 20-year career as a beauty and health writer, I have interviewed a lot of people. Supermodels, entrepreneurs, authors, celebrities, and doctors. And many of these conversations had a real impact on me, and I'd come away feeling inspired, excited, informed, and really empowered. And at the back of my mind, I'd always think, I wish I could just publish the tape so people could really feel that conversation. Well, on this podcast, you get to feel the conversation. I talk with experts, guests, and a few friends who I hope will inspire, inform, and empower you, and maybe also challenge you, whether you're looking for self-help, self-improvement, beauty advice, health insights, business know-how, or just some good old-fashioned life advice and a bit of a laugh. It's all here. Welcome to the show. I don't know about you, but I love to hear about people who pursue their dreams. I love those stories. The path to get there, the path to realize your dream may not always be smooth. And in fact, that makes for a much more interesting story. And it may not be what you think. But when someone sets their eye on a prize and achieves it, I'm always very happy to sit down and hear that story. And perhaps the story we have all heard versions of is one of making it in the movies. Maybe you're watching Hollywood on Netflix right now, or you've heard the many stories about actors or actresses who were waiting tables in Hollywood one minute, then walking the red carpet of the movie premiere they were the star of the next. They are wonderful stories and always bring a tear to my eye. I don't know why, but they do. It's a really seductive story, right? It's really seductive to hear those tales. And the idea of making it in the movies is one that I thought looked a certain way. And obviously there are lots of different types of movies, but my friend Duncan has made a movie. He's a writer and I think he co-produced this film, but he wrote it and he's written another and is in the process of making that too. His independent film, My Feral Heart, which came out in 2016, was nominated for 3 British Independent Film Awards and has received huge acclaim and support from film critics, including Mark Kermode, who is perhaps my favourite film critic of all time. He's amazing. Also James King, special mention. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has actually been described as, where it has a hugely positive rating, I hasten to add, it's been described as a beautifully realised, understated character study bolstered by strong performances, distinctive cinematography and a deeply evocative score. Now, Duncan was not a full-time writer when he wrote My Feral Heart. He was not connected in the traditional sense of the word, and he didn't buy his way into the film industry. All of those things you might think have to happen in order for you to be able to make a movie, none of that was really present. In fact, Duncan was working as a counsellor when he wrote his first film. But what does it take to make a movie? How do you meet film producers? Is it all networking and this and that and the other? And how do you hire actors? How do you realise a dream like this? And I've said this about previous conversations with my guests, particularly my friends in the beauty industry who have created huge, huge brands, that there's no blueprint for success. There is no well-trodden path that guarantees if you follow that path that you'll be one of the people who makes it. So what does it take? In this conversation, Duncan tells me his story from scuppered dreams as a professional sportsman, recalibrating and deciding to pursue a passion whilst also focusing on a career that would, let's face it, just be real here, pay the bills, and how over time he came closer and closer and then eventually realised his dream of making a movie. These kinds of stories are my jam, and I hope you enjoy listening to this conversation, because here he is, Duncan Paveling, on The Emma Gunn Show. Duncan Paveley, it is so nice to have you on the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be asked.
Well, I think back to why I started the Emma Gunn Show, and much of it was about finding inspiration in the stories of people behind brands, because as you know, my background is as a beauty journalist. Mm. And as the show has grown, it was four a couple of weeks ago, it's really grown and expanded, but it's never really lost that seed of inspiring stories from inspirational people. And I think your story is wonderful because you are someone who has turned a passion for film into your job. And I think a lot of people would probably say they feel passionate about films. Mm-hmm. My passion for the Marvel movies, for example, I think should get me into all of the Marvel after parties with the entire cast and crew. Apparently it doesn't work like that. It would be you. But you have, I think it's extraordinary. So for the context of, and we'll tell the entire story, mm-hmm. but in your 30s, you wrote a film that went mm-hmm. on to win awards. And mm-hmm. that was, I guess, the beginning of you starting a proper, in inverted commas, film career.
Yeah.
But the journey has not been, you were some wunderkind who did film studies at school and it was always going to be your destiny. Like for mm-hmm. a long time, it was something. Did you feel it was inaccessible?
I think from a young age, it's something that I always had an interest in. And, you know, I think back to the first VHS that I watched was Indiana Jones, like, and just my best friend at school, we were about 6 years old or whatever it was, and his dad worked for Radio Rentals and he had a video player and we watched it. And I just remember just like, it was amazing. And then started watching movies and I was quite, I'd say in some sense, an introverted sort of kid, and would spend a lot of time growing up watching movies. And I think always had a love and an interest for it, but didn't really until my mid-teens kind of consider that you could actually do something around that. And I don't think that even at school I felt that it was achievable, because I wasn't academic. I wasn't necessarily like, I mean, I loved English, I loved stories and storytelling, but I couldn't, like, I found it really difficult at the time to kind of get those ideas out. So yeah, I think definitely at the time it felt inaccessible.
And it's a passion as well. I think you can say, it's interesting you said that, you know, I always had an interest in it, but an interest doesn't mean you can then go on and make a career out of it. Like I have an interest in being an actress. I'm not going to go and do it. Like I never did. So, but what I mean is, I think is there's a really interesting moment when mm-hmm. an interest becomes something mm-hmm. more. And I wonder whether it's because it defines the person in a way that's just more than a hobby.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think there were kind of like several little kind of moments as opposed to one big one. I think that obviously probably the biggest one was when we finally got, you know, when we finally made the decision to make Wife for a Heart. But I think before that there were lots of little kind of steps, and in between
My
those
Feral
steps
Heart
kind of
being, My Feral Heart being the movie that went on to win awards and, you know, huge yeah. amount of acclaim.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean it's still kind of, yeah, I mean it still feels quite dreamlike in some ways, you know, when we think about kind of where it ended up and how it was received. But I think there was a belief from the start of it, when we got into it, that it would find an audience. I don't know whether I think you always hope that it would have the kind of response that it did, but in terms of believing in the project, believing what you're doing was the most important thing, and working with people that had a similar kind of belief or a similar kind of place in their time was really, really important. But I think before then it was little sort of steps, I suppose. I mean, for a long time as a kid, I was very sporty. I played a lot of cricket. I played kind of representative cricket from the age of 14 to 26, like for different counties. And when I was younger, I thought that would be my path. That was the thing I thought I was going to do. And about 18, 19, I had the opportunity to I came very close to earning a contract at Derbyshire County Cricket Club.
Oh, wow.
And their the coach that had kind of invited me up and wanted me to be part of his plans, between the winter and the summer, when he got the sack. And so my kind of dreams of that went with him. They had a change of personnel and they had different ideas and it didn't fit. And I think probably that's when, even though I played representative cricket for another sort of 5 or 6 years, it wasn't with the same kind of mindset. I felt that was probably when that shifted. And that was when I started to think about sort of, you know, film and such. But initially I was working in kind of like as a job, I was working in care and stuff around that time. But also my very first job, I was very fortunate in the sense that through my studies, because I did eventually find my way, I did A-levels. I struggled through GCSE English, but I did A-level GCSEs. A-levels English, rather. And media. And that's when I started to think, oh, this is great. I can see this happening. And I fortunately got to know the composer Barrington Feelong through our local cricket club that I played for. And he lived down the road. And I, you know, it just was one of those things. And I got to meet him, got to know him. And eventually, before I left college, he offered me a job. I knew nothing about music at the time. I knew about film music and knew about film and TV. But so I went to work for him and worked for him for a couple of years. And it was the most amazing experience. I got to see filmmaking TV from another point of view.
Wow.
But after that, I was still in my 20s and I still had this thing of playing cricket. So I went to Australia and played cricket for sort of about a season and a half. So I had like 5 seasons effectively in a row, sort of summer here, summer Australia. And then it was like that, it was almost like that was when I realized that wasn't how my life was going to be. It wasn't going to be sport. And then I was kind of like, how do I get into film? I didn't know. So, you know, I'd left the kind of the industry slightly with having worked with Barrington for that time. And then I took some work in care. So I started doing work with young people with learning difficulties and special needs. And just started to sort of work in that sort of field for a few years and then went back to London to work in film for a bit. And then came out of it again. I had this experience of kind of flitting between these two things, and to the point, I think I ended up working for a company called Magnet Films, which was at the time was started by Sir David Frost. And I had this sort of 18-month period there, and I thought that was going to be it. I thought this is it. This is when it's all going to happen. And it didn't quite work out that way for various reasons, and I left. Not disillusioned, but I learned a hell of a lot in that time. But it didn't go, I suppose, to plan. I suppose it didn't take me to where I thought it was going to do. But ultimately, it did, because what I learned in that time was far more important than what I thought.
Well, what was the key learning then from that experience?
I think the thing I realized at that point was, well, first and foremost, I wanted to write. Secondly is how I would want to work and how I'd the kind of relationships I'd want to build with people, you know, and also in terms of timing, I made a very clear decision around that time. I was about mid-20s that it's a precarious industry and you've got to, you know, so much of it will come from you and your own endeavour, your own hard work, your own belief. And I think at that point, I came out of it thinking, okay, what am I also passionate about? What do I also love? What do I think I'll be good at? You know, what can I have? What skill can I have for the rest of my life that allows me to write, allows me to develop this and follow a dream? Even if it's 5 years off, 10 years off, 20 years off, it doesn't matter because, you know, I believe that it's worth investing in. And so I trained as a counsellor and therapist, and that was like my mid-20s. I was about 24, I think. And within a few years, I'd qualified I was working at three different jobs at the time in care alongside it. So I was doing kind of work in a school as just, you know, sort of supporting families and young people. I was doing care work outside of that. So visiting people's homes and doing care work one-to-one. And I was doing sessional work for social services, taking young people to visit their families who were in foster care. And it was an amazing experience, and I got to meet incredible people, and it just really broadened my thought process, I suppose, and got an incredible insight into the lives of others and how similar we are as opposed to how different we are, I think. And I think the film industry, having had an experience that taught me a lot in that those mid-20s, it was very different to the experience I had working with Barrington was just the most wonderful experience. And yeah, you know, it's obviously, he sadly passed away only just last year, and you know, he has been a dear friend in all those years, for 20 plus years. And I think that experience was so much of what I took into the experience when we got to Make Feral, was about how you engage with people, how you treat people, no matter whether they're a runner, to the director, to an actor, to the sound person, you know, whoever it is, everyone deserves to be treated equally and fairly and honestly and respectfully. And that's what I learned in the early experience. But and then coupled with the care work, I think, again, it just allows you to feel human. I think that's the thing. I think a lot of the industry, the film industry, can feel inaccessible, can feel elite, can feel you have to tiptoe around it, maybe. And watch what you say and do, and not be yourself, and try and be something you're not. And actually, I think there's a massive shift in how the industry is going. You know, we're not there yet, but I think there's a lot of change, and I think a lot of people are starting to look at things differently and starting to say, well, we can be different, we can be independent, we can have our families around us on set. There is, you know, a push for more you know, sort of gender equality. There is, you know, a much sort of more balanced industry in terms of the way we think and the way we behave. And there's been massively significant kind of shifts in that, but we've got a long way to go.
Yeah, you mentioned one of the words you used there was the film industry has this perception of being precarious, and I think you wouldn't have had to have done any research into movies in terms of the business side of it. I think everybody would understand that it's hard to get into movies. I think you could stop 100 people on the street and say, how easy do you think it is to get into movies? And they'd all go, oh, it's quite hard, isn't it? And you mentioned precarious, but but once you're in it, is it like that? I mean, you've said that it's changing for the better, but when you sort of get beyond the velvet rope, as it were, and you start working within it, is it just like any other industry?
I think the thing I always stand by is, whatever industry you work in, there will be people you will gravitate towards and connect with, and others that you don't. And that's the same for any sector. Mm-hmm. And I think that the thing that I going into it, I maintain and will hopefully continue to maintain, is to be yourself and not attempt to wear a mask in any way, and certainly kind of be genuine. And I think you will attract people who are similar minded, because I think that there are people out there who would generally care about the industry, care about each other, will support each other. I think there is maybe a slight difference, maybe an independent film to maybe, you know, the blockbusters.
They're
different machines, and there's nothing to say that they're not both enjoyable and they're not both wonderful environments to be in. I think you have positive and negative in both. But I think, I still think I'm right. We're at the early stages, really. I mean, we're going back to going to our next project, you know, our next shoot, our next project, or we're due to shoot our next projects in September. That looks likely to be sometime next year now, unfortunately, with everything that's going on, but understandably. I mean, I think the key thing is, I think you will always find people who are like-minded if you are honest and genuine. I think that's the key thing. And reminder that everybody was just like you at one point. There was a point where things maybe became a little bit more accessible or a little bit easier. I think in this industry now, or I think at this time in our lives, I think in terms of getting films made, I think there are opportunities to do things, obviously on a very small scale, easier. You know, people can shoot stuff, as they've proved, on their mobile phones and things like that. The biggest issue is getting them out there, you know, getting seen. That is the biggest thing, and that's one of the biggest challenges that we encountered with Feral was actually getting it out there and getting it seen, because we had done it. It almost worked against us at one point, the way we did it. Eventually it worked with us, but it's that thing of when you work completely out of the system without any sort of support from established kind of company or, you know, kind of backer, and it's purely independent to a degree, you know, it was difficult then to kind of for people to let you know to take hold of it, because they didn't have an investment from it from the start. So I think getting it out there is actually more of the issue than getting it made.
Let's take a few steps back, because you and I both have a similar experience with school, in that we probably weren't the ones who really got what they were trying to get out of us, and so I definitely underperformed. Was very creative, but just didn't have an outlet. And you said something similar earlier about perhaps not acing things. Yeah. But then you had this, you decided you wanted to write. And I had a similar experience, but I thought, but I don't have a track record. I don't have a GCSE that proves this. I don't have an A-level that backs up that I have this skill. So how did you sort of funnel it down to, I want to write, with that in the back of your mind? And then how did you grow in confidence to be able to put pen to paper?
I've always been writing for, like, since I was a teenager, really, I suppose, probably certainly like mid-teens, I've always written in some way, shape or form. But yeah, as I say, my English teacher was lovely at school, but she, you know, she'd always say, oh, you know, if only he could. And it was always that thing of like, and it was a block. And I don't feel, and I think this is still the case in some educational settings, that an alternative way of learning is there for some people. And I clearly didn't learn the traditional way, which I appreciate fits, you know, probably 80% or maybe slightly less, but it's a good percentage of people. So if somebody got hold of me then and said, how about trying this way, which is what happened when I went to do A-levels, I took classics on a whim, and I had the most incredible classics tutor. I didn't know anything about what it was. It just sounded interesting on the day. I had a subject I had to choose, so I just chose it. And I had a teacher, a guy called Mick, who was just incredible. The only way to describe him, he was kind of like Robin Williams' character in Dead Poets Society. He had that kind of rapport with his students. People would, you know, he'd hang off every word. And I think in terms of film as well, at that point, he would come in and talk about film, and he would talk about stuff he'd seen. And I'd be like, wow, this is, and everyone else was like, switch off, I think, at some point, because it was film, it wasn't classics. And then he'd turn it around and start to say, yeah, because this is all about this, you know, classic, you know, mythology, that is, they've just taken that story and shifted it into this. But he would have us take a chapter, go off in groups, and then come back and reenact it in any way we wanted, comedy, drama, you know, whatever, silent, you know. And so we'd have an experience of it. He'd have us outside with rulers and stuff and tops of desks, kind of reenacting battles. So you physically learnt it, and I still remember those things to this day, and that's like nearly 25 years ago. And he was someone that really kind of allowed me to think or believe that things could be different, that I can learn, and I can learn in a different way. And I started to write more then. I started to look at different films and different, you know, different types of filmmaking. But I think the real key thing in terms of the belief, when I decided to, I did a bit of soul searching when I came back from Australia, sort of like my early 20s, and I had a couple of years where things didn't quite work out for me out there, that, you know, in the way I'd have hoped. Came back and sort of just spent some time just working on myself. I did a lot of kind of, soul searching is probably the best way. I class myself as more of a spiritual person than anything else. And read some life-changing books, like, you know, not that I'm a religious, but the series Conversations with God, which are amazing, and Jonathan Livingston Seagull, which is incredible. And I, over these books, kind of changed my life. The music I listened to changed me, you know, music of Tom Waits, Nick Cave, you know, Neil Young, those kind of, that time, I just, they're great storytellers, and that really helped. And then I made the decision to train as a counsellor, and that was a key thing, because I found a way of working and studying, and all of a sudden I was getting essays back and journals back, and they were like top marks, and I just mm-hmm. aced them. And I was like in my mid-20s, and I was like, I'd never had that experience. Maybe a little bit when I was doing some media at college, because it was something I was really passionate about, and I could be practical about it. But from an academic, classic academic point of view, whenever I submitted anything before, it would be like, you know, it would be thrown back at me.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the case. I just found a way of being creative with the truth. That sounds wrong to say creative with the truth. but it was about, you know, a large part of your training when you're counselling is part of that self-discovery, and kind of being very, very kind of comfortable with yourself and sure of yourself in a positive way, and not allowing the things and your experiences to influence your work with others in a negative way. And I'd done a lot of that work before I got to that point. So actually, when it came to that, I could just focus on my explanation of that or my experience of that. And I just found a way of, I suppose, communicating myself to others better. And I was able to believe in myself a bit more through that. And then I suppose to some degree, getting positivity back and saying, this is good, this is different, but it's great, you know, was lovely to hear. Because so often I'd heard in younger years is there's potential or it's different, but it doesn't fit. And I'm just like, different can be wonderful. And I think that's the thing, is that so often we miss that, you know, and when we look at people who change things in the world throughout history and even now, they're usually people who do something different. And something I often say to particularly young people when they're, in a counselling setting, they often talk about, you know, how they feel different and the difficulty they find in being different at a young age. And I might ask them who inspires them, you know, whether it's someone now or in the past, whether it's some, you know, a musician or, you know, or an actor or, you know, whoever it might be. And often they'll list off give me a huge list of people, and it will be people who are different, people who are original, people who probably went through similar things to them. And then I say, okay, so what is it you like about them? And they'll always say, or so often say, because they're different, because they're unique, because that's okay, you know. And as a saying, you can see that, okay, so it's okay to be that. And maybe this is the point, this is kind of like when the shell kind of cracks, and I can be something else. I can be the thing I want to be, because I think for so long we're governed by our experiences and the people around us, and the thumbprints of everybody else in our early life are on us. And we get to a point in our mid-teens where we start to challenge that, and the cracks start to appear, and we see people as human beings. And it allows us to start to say, well, it's okay for me to be different. It's okay for me to remold and put my own stamp on things and go my own way. And that's tough for most teenagers. And I actually feel for teenagers more now than when I was a teenager. So I think I think there's more challenges in their way these days.
Agreed. Yeah. Now, you trained as a counsellor, still wanting to write, still wanting, mm-hmm. I guess, at some point to get into film in some way. Mm-hmm. But obviously counselling is a full-time job and is a vocation and a career. So was it always in your mind that at some point the balance was going to shift and it would be 100% counselling, 0% film, 99% counselling, 1% film. And then just over time, that would begin to get even, and then film would then be the thing that was dominant.
Yeah, I think that was always the plan. I think from that point, when I left the industry in sort of early to mid-20s and I decided to train as a counsellor, it was a very clear decision then that initially I'm going to have to invest in, I'm going to have to find, have a job that pays the bills, and I'm going to have to invest in this skill. It was something I was passionate about, and it's something I will always have, and I will build a career, a practice out of that. Initially, it was working in schools, and you know, once I'd finished training, I was then able to have the time to write more. So the idea was I had sort of a day job, and I would then, and I started to build a private practice. I've been counselling now for 15 years, and for 10 years of that, I've had my own private practice. I started with one client, and, you know, and that built and built and built. And the more that built, then I could step away from the day job. So that went from 5 days a week to 4 days a week to 3 days a week. And eventually that came to no days a week and just doing private practice and then working on the film side of things and the writing full time and the counselling being part time. So, and the intention was always to get to a point where maybe I'm running a practice and I could just do some voluntary work. I can just provide a few hours a week counselling to people who can't afford it, or, you know, to a voluntary organisation. And that is still the plan and very close to it. You know, so that was always the way. So there was a gradual thing. It wasn't overnight, and there wasn't a clear point where it significantly changed. It was a gradual thing. And I think it was just believing that that was how it could be done. It was harder at the beginning because you're doing different jobs and you're training.
Did you ever think, gosh, it's been a month and I haven't written such and such? Do you know what I mean? Because you're taking on, you had a lot on your plate, and there was always room for everything. And I'm just wondering if at any point the passion, because when the passion doesn't pay the bills and when the passion doesn't really can't be presented to somebody in a certain way, you know, you can't show anything tangible for it. I wonder whether it can sometimes, did it ever feel like a struggle to keep it active?
It's weird you say about that, you know, the passion doesn't pay the bills. For me, the passion is the bills. It's almost like they're the thing that kind of keep you going. It's like, I don't know, I think, probably, yeah. I mean, there probably were times when you think, why am I knackered all the time? And you just, you know, you're just like, I'm shattered, and, you know, life is happening, you know, and I'm, but again, it comes down to that belief. I think, you know, if you don't believe there's an end result, then there is no point in doing it. You know, but I always believed there would be an end result. I'd always believed. I have to admit, I think I was always, again, looking back at those school reports I was digging out recently, where, you know, we were about to move and was going through some old things, and they were saying the same thing. Oh, you know, he's a bit of a dreamer, and, you know, he's, you know, if he can, he can put his ideas into practice and all this kind of thing. I think that was a large part of it. And it wasn't because I was unable. I just think it was because I just didn't have the belief in myself at the time. I've always had a wonderfully supportive family and friendship group, and they all believed in me, but I didn't believe in me, you know, and that was the biggest thing. Like, the moment I believed in myself, which was probably in my mid-20s, things changed for me in every area of my life. Everything I set out to achieve in that time, from that point, I've achieved. Every single thing that I've said, I want to do this, or I'm going to do this. It's not even I want, I'm going to do this. I've done, from making a movie to building a private practice, to running a marathon, you know, having a family, you know, all these kind of things. There are things that say I'm going to do this. Sometimes they've taken a little longer than I'd hoped for various reasons, and sometimes that's unavoidable. That is the way life throws things at you. But certainly, chosen not to put any more obstacles in my way. The biggest.
Oh, that's an interesting way of describing it.
I think to be honest, more often than not, we tend to put most of the obstacles in our way. You know, life will throw enough at us as it is. You know, life, as we're learning at the moment, with all that's going on, you know, the life, like, there are forces of nature that are out of our control. And one thing I always think about is the one thing we always have control over is how we react.
Mm.
You know, there's no way. I mean, if we think of, in its simplest terms, we look out the window and it's pouring with rain, but we're wearing shorts and a t-shirt. Do we not go out? Well, of course we do. We just change and we go. We adapt. We're not going to stop it raining just because we're wearing shorts and a t-shirt.
Yeah,
so I think it's really important that sometimes we learn to adapt and we learn to react, and we don't put any more obstacles in our way than will always be there. There will always be things that will challenge us, because there's one certainty in life is that we are going to have different forms of loss. There are going to be times in life where things aren't going to go maybe to plan and aren't work out the way we hope, but it takes us in a different direction and maybe we'll learn something else about ourselves. And I look back at the meandering I've done, and there's definitely been a lot of meandering over the years, but I don't look back and regret anything, not a single thing, because...
But do you... Go on, I was going to say, is that because even when you're meandering, you're not staying in one place, one foot is still going in front of the other, which means that it was part of the journey to where you are now?
Absolutely. And I think, to be honest with you, actually, meandering may not do that journey justice in a sense, because meandering almost sounds negative, doesn't it? Meandering sounds like aimlessly meandering around. I used to do that in my teens, definitely, to avoid things. I think I used to, lasting memories, and people, all my school friends say this, I always used to be the one at the back of the class that everyone was waiting for as I dithered, trying to gather everything, and I, you know, was disorganized and stuff. And quite the opposite now, I'm super organized. I've learned a way to adapt, I suppose. But I think I'm a firm believer in process. I suppose there is always an end goal to a process, but I've always found personally that actually the achievement is not the end goal. The end, when I get to that point, to that end point, or whatever that chapter is, whatever that thing is, the process has been the thing I've been most proud of or valued most. Marathons are a good example. I was talking to someone the other day about this and said it's lovely to sort of pull out the finisher's medal and go, wow, I did that, because it was only three years ago yesterday I did my first one. On social media it pops up and reminds you, and I was like, wow, it's amazing. But actually the thing I valued most was the training, 4.5 months of training, and remembering the process and remembering that first run. And it was like 2 or 3 miles or something, or, you know, and I was thinking, you know, I had thoughts of, wow, 2 or 3 miles, how am I going to do 26? And at that point, I straight away told myself, you're not running that yet. Just run this one, you know, run this mile. And life is like that. I often talk to people about that lovely phrase of, if you look after the pennies, the pounds will look after themselves. Mm. And I say to people, you know, think about your moments in life or days in your life being the pennies. Look after today, and you know, if you look after then tomorrow and the next, you'll have a great week, you'll have a good month, you'll have a good year. You know, there will be ups and downs, but overall, if you look after today and cherish it and look after yourself and the people around you, then that's how we build the weeks, and that's how we build the months and the years, and that's how we build a lifetime. And that's kind of, I think, how I've attempted to approach things in every sense of my life, is that we have to do sometimes the things that we don't want to do, build those foundations, the boring stuff. Like, you know, if you are building a house or decorating a house, you know, there's no point in kind of wallpaper or paint, you know, a wall that's crumbling. You know, get it plastered, let it dry, be patient, invest in the process, because you'll get to that point. When you paint it, when you wallpaper it, and you're putting furniture in and you're enjoying it, you're having people over. But you'll probably look back and go, wow, haven't we worked hard for this? Or, you know, remember when? And they're the things that I find are the greater achievements, is the process as opposed to the actual, the end goal.
Yeah, I often think if something's hard work, I have that moment of feeling frustrated or like, oh, I just wish this was easy. And then I always remind myself, you don't wish this was easy. Mm-hmm. Because if it's worth having, if it's worth getting to,
absolutely,
whether that's spending 3 years hounding someone to be a guest on the podcast or whatever, I know that then it will be worth it in the end. Mm. Can we go back and unpick something you said? And I'm guessing there's not going to be a magic bullet.
Okay.
But you said in your mid-20s, you something shifted. Mm. And that was when you understood how to or began to believe in yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think if I could write.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
The formula for that, and share it with my listeners, I would be so happy. Mm-hmm. And I would love to know the formula. If you were to look back with a critical mind on the what made up the component parts of you being able to believe in yourself, not doubt yourself, not letting other people's opinions knock that, because that's a lot of what it comes down to, certainly with me, and I know a lot of listeners will probably be nodding their heads. What was it for you that allowed you to believe in yourself?
I think there was probably a number of things. I mean, the thing that immediately spring to mind, I think first and foremost is exactly what you just picked up on, is about other people's opinions. People will always have opinions, and it's unrealistic for us to ever believe, I think, that universally there will be one singular opinion about any one thing. So, you know, it's about whether we focus on, I mean, again, you know, if we had a conversation with 10 people, we might agree with 9 of them, but that one person we don't. Sometimes there is a tendency for us to focus on that, on the negative, and not go with the majority. It doesn't mean we ignore it. I would encourage people to listen to everything, absorb everything that, you know, in terms of opinions, because we can always dismiss them. We don't have to believe them. You know, we don't have to invite them in. It's like, you know, someone's negative opinion can be banging at the door, but we can keep it locked. And I think that, you know, we don't have to open our door to everything and everyone. And I think that was a key part, is that people are going to have opinions, and people are going to like things, and people are going to hate things. You know, I always generally, I'd like to go into things hoping I'll love it. And if I don't, that's, you know, fair enough. I'll move on to the next thing. But I think that was a big part of it, is not being hurt by the things that people said. And I think probably I always wore my, I mean, that's the one thing my parents always instilled in me, is be honest, be truthful, be yourself. And I think that's not always easy when you're growing up, when you're a teenager. And I always wore my heart on my sleeve, always. And I generally stood up for other people more than I stood up for myself. And I think I got to a point where I found a better balance of that I would stick up for myself a little bit more, as well as others. But I certainly realised that it's okay to wear your heart on your sleeve, and actually the scars that you get from doing that only allow you to make better decisions in the future. It doesn't mean you don't wear your heart on your sleeve. It doesn't mean you stop being who you are. You just become hopefully a better person, you know, or not a better, but a better version of yourself because of it. If we only have things work out for us, what happens when something does happen that's challenging? You know, we, as we sort of touched upon earlier, you know, things, life is going to throw stuff at you no matter what you do, no matter how hard you would try and avoid it, you know, duck and dive, things will find you. So it's important just to learn how we react. And again, I think learning not to be hurt by other people and what they say, allow them to have their opinion. And actually, sometimes the things that we find hurtful are worth listening to, because sometimes there's truth in them. And I think it's really important that we don't dismiss that. And I think it's really important that, and certainly from my point of view, there are things that have been hurtful to me because they're not true.
Right.
And there are sometimes things that have been hurtful because I know deep down that they've touched upon something that is absolutely true. And yeah, it's really important that I listen to it. And I make the choice. I don't change because they've told me to or because they think I'm doing something wrong. I change because I want to, because I think that that will benefit me. And I think that's been a key part, I think. Fear is another. Generally the thing that holds people back from achieving, and achievement isn't financial. Achievement is in so many different forms. You know, we achieve on a daily basis, but we don't always recognize it. And I think that's really important. For some people, being able to, in difficult times, sometimes being able to get up, have a shower, and get out the door to go to the shops is an achievement, and it's important that they acknowledge that. I don't think we should be comparing ourselves to people. I think that's a problem we fall down a lot in. We compare ourselves to others. You might as well. Why would we compare an apple to an orange? Like, they're just completely different things. They taste different. They look different. You know, you can eat one with the skin on. You have to peel the other. I mean, it's just like, it doesn't make any sense. And that's what we're like as individuals. We might have similarities, and we're, you know, there are core things that are similar about us, but we are all different. And it's so important. The moment we start to compare ourselves to others, we're only ever going to lose, you know. So just be the best version of yourself. And, you know, and fear holds so many of us back from doing things. And I think what's so key is sometimes we have to, you know, despite how we're feeling, despite how we're thinking, we have to do. And I think that so much of the things that I class as a personal achievement, no matter how big or small they might seem to other people, it's been because I've done, even though I've been anxious about it, nervous about it, I thought, yeah, this could come back to bite me, or this might not work out, or people might not like it, but do I like it, you know, and is it worth that risk? And if I never do it, I'll never know.
It's good advice. It's good advice. And actually, I had Mandy Salagari on this podcast, and also Jeff Thompson, fellow filmmaker, recently. And neither of them said it on tape, I don't think. It was when we were chatting before and up before or after. But we were talking about trigger culture and about people say, like, it's very common now to hear people say, I was triggered by that, or I'm very triggered by this and it set off my anxiety. And both of them said a version of, if something triggers you, unpick it. Don't walk away from it. Don't tell someone to stop doing it. Face it head on, unpick it, figure out why it triggers you, and take the power away.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's that is so key. And I think it's very easy. I mean, I'm in the counseling work that I'm doing, and what I've learned about myself is how we label things and how we give words and things power. In the language we use, we reaffirm the negative beliefs we have so often, you know, and we can take one word and we could catastrophize it. I mean, examples might be someone says, oh, that's a silly thing to say. Oh, I'm silly, am I? You know, that's a ridiculous thing to say. Oh, I'm ridiculous. We kind of catastrophize these things, and we make them so much bigger than they have to be. And also sometimes when people, we might discuss how we're feeling. And before we've even talked about the feeling that is clearly having an impact on us, we start to apologize for it. We say, oh, it's silly. Oh, I shouldn't be feeling like this. Or it's ridiculous to say this. But it's never ridiculous to acknowledge how you feel. If you don't acknowledge how you feel, you'll never get through it. If you constantly put that obstacle in your way of labeling it as ridiculous or silly or insignificant, then you're saying that your feelings are insignificant. You're saying that you are insignificant, and you're not. None of us are insignificant. You know, we're all unique, and we all have something amazing about us. You know, and sometimes people find that early on in life, and sometimes people find that at the end of their life.
What if someone's listening to this and they don't believe that right now? They don't believe that there's something special about them. What would you say to the person listening who feels like that?
One of the things, I'm not a huge advocate of the words right and wrong. Obviously, we have certain the law and rules. I'm not saying that there's not right and wrong in that sense, but in a general sense, right and wrong. But there was a lovely phrase that somebody once mentioned to me, which uses those phrases, and I love the sentiment in it. And I have to always check myself before I say it, because I often get tongue-tied and say it wrong. But there's nothing that's wrong with us. That's what right with us can't fix. And whilst I say I don't believe in necessarily right or wrong, I believe that there's a best way of doing things. But I would say to anybody is that, you know, we all have something, and we all have something. And you know, sometimes we don't discover that because we're so focused on the problem. We're so focused on the things that we can't do. And so often we miss the things that we can. And I think that for anyone that feels that they have that lack of belief, or they don't feel that, I think, again, I'd always encourage people to kind of just focus on each day is stripping away the things that we can't do. You know, every time we find ourselves saying, well, I can't do that and I can't do that. You know, there's loads of things I'm not able to do at the moment, but that's partly because, you know, it's not that I can't do them. It's just that, you know, maybe I'm not built that way or not designed that. I mean, I can't have a baby. I mean, that's, you know, that's one definite thing I can't, you know, but I'm not physically built to have one. So, you know, that's not going to, you know, and there are certain things that we say we can't do. And actually, it's a word that I like to remove from people's vocabulary. It's okay to say, I won't do it, or I'm not ready to do it, or, you know, I'm finding it difficult to do at the moment. But to say I can't do it is a massive obstacle that we just plonked in front of us and said, you know, climb that wall, you know. And
well, it's a dead end, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I think that, you know, I think that's a big part of sometimes listening to the language we use. We all have, I'm a firm believer in the work I do and just sort of personally as well, that to a degree, we're all kids in an adult's body, you know. The first sort of four or five of our years are so important in the way we learn about the world. And I mentioned earlier about people's thumbprints. You know, we've got people's thumbprints all over us. And sometimes those are wonderful and positive and nurturing, and other times maybe not. Sadly, in some situations, you know, that those can be extremely negative. And when we look back growing through the years, we might look back at photographs and we have other people's memories of them, you know. So we'll look at a photograph and someone's describing, oh, that's the day you fell off your bike and this, and this. Well, that's their interpretation. That might not be ours. So as we go through life, we start to kind of almost sieve out, you know, and filter out other people's things and start to think about what our interpretation of those things were, or our experiences were of those things. And I think that those 4 or 5 years are so, so significant. And we carry those with us into adulthood. And sometimes they're really positive and sometimes they're maladaptive. Things that we've learned and we've seen, we do, just don't work in adult life. And that's the turning point. That's the turning when we recognize that. The moment we recognize something's not working for us, we have a choice. And that is the most powerful thing. At the moment, I think this is where I think, obviously, in the current climate, it's some choice has been taken away, and rightly so and understandably so. But at the moment, we still have choices. Every day we have a choice. But under, you know, what we might consider more regular, normal, I don't usually use the word normal. There'll be a new normal when we come out of this. But under regular kind of circumstances, we have a huge amount of choice. And the moment we recognise that, then it's about the doing. Doing in spite of the feeling, doing in spite of the thought, doing in spite of opinions, you know. Because at the moment we let those things, we invite those things in, we're putting more obstacles in our way. you know, and that could be as simple as getting up for a run in the morning. You know, we set our alarm, we get up. I can't find my shoes. Oh, I didn't get my, oh, that's not clean. And before we know it, the half an hour we should have been running, we've been looking for the gear. We go, oh, it's too late now, I'll start tomorrow.
Yeah.
Whereas if we've got everything right ready the night before, we just get up, we put in our gear on, and as we're having these sorts of, oh, it's early, I'm tired, we're walking out the door because we're dressed. And then we start to think differently, we start to feel differently. And if we can do that consistently for a period of time, you know, I say to most people, we often talk about the 21 days of change. If you do something consistently for 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks, you know, and push through those thoughts and feelings and just do, you will notice a difference. You know, you might even start to enjoy those things.
Well, this is really interesting because we've talked about the sort of things you have to unpick within yourself in order to get out of your own way. Essentially, it's kind of breaking it down. But you're also very good at choosing, and obviously have had great relationships. You mentioned Barrington earlier with mentors. How important is it, do you think, to find a mentor, particularly with something like you're doing, which is a creative or seen as an industry that's quite difficult to get into? And do you think that even matters? But how important is it to find a mentor, do you think?
Well, it's interesting, the word mentor. I mean, obviously, when we think of that, I think of Mr. Miyagi. But when you think about, when you do think about mentors, in this, in the way we are now, and in, as a society, our mentors don't have to be someone we know necessarily. I think when we look at a mentor, we're looking at people who inspire us and we learn from. And that can come from past, present, and obviously there will be people in the future that will influence us in different ways. I have been extremely fortunate. You know, I class myself extremely fortunate and really honoured to have worked with Barrington at that stage of my life. It was the first job I ever had. It was built on a relationship that we built on something else, you know, through our love of sport. And he's family. He has always been family ever since. And, you know, his family, I class as family. I mean, his boys were probably around, I'm guessing, I'm trying to work it back now because they'll kill me if I get their ages wrong. they were probably like 6 and 8, I think, at the time. And there were times when things, you know, they'd be around, you know, more in the school holidays and stuff, and we'd be playing cricket in the garden, or, you know, doing these kind of things, and it felt like a family. And I, you know, he was so. I think I'm mindful of not mentioning names. I will mention names in the positive sense because I had the good fortune whilst working with Barrington that we were working on the film Hillary and Jackie, which was about the life of Jacqueline Dupre, the cellist. With Emily Watson and Rachel Griffiths, and they ended up both Oscar nominated for that beautiful film. And I was fortunate that I sat next to Barrington through pretty much every note he wrote on that. Whilst Matt, who was his kind of main kind of, I was kind of there as a assistant to his assistant sort of thing. Matt, who's a wonderful composer in his own right now. And you know he's doing some great work. He was in the other room, kind of preparing all the music because we were quite tight to a deadline. I sat with him during that process, but what I learned from that process was about process. But I also learned that I saw the way Anand Tucker, the director, managed people and dealt with people. And to this day, I hadn't actually sort of spoken to Anand for probably about a year or so, but I know that if I dropped him a message or emailed him or picked up a phone, he would be responsive. And the way he allowed me to feel when I was sort of 19, you know, years old, my first job, the way I felt around him was just remarkable. And the way I felt around Barrington was remarkable. I felt so respected and valued. And they were mentors. And I remember just before... it was about a week before we shot My Feral Heart. I emailed Anand, and I just said, look, you know, it's taken me this time to get to where I wanted to do. I said, but I always think back to my experience on Hillary and Jackie. And I remember how I felt as part of a team, a part of a crew, and how you treated me, how you welcomed me, and how warm you were. I said, if however this film turns out, if at the end of it, I believe that other people have had that experience, then that's the greatest achievement. And he was really sweet and humble. He was like, oh, he's such a lovely man. And he was just like, oh, the fact that you felt that way of that experience means so much, you know, that people felt that way. And I think people did. It was a wonderful experience. And I think that for me was mentoring directly, you know, people you actually in a physical company. Mm. I think you can learn from people that don't do things the way you, I mean, I've certainly met and worked with people that I would choose to work differently, and that has influenced the way things have been since. And I made a very clear decision in my mid-20s. I said, and you know, I said this to friends and family, I said, I want to go back to this when I'm ready, and I want to work with people that I care about and I trust. And in Jane, obviously, Jane Gull directed My Full Heart. She's, you know, a godmother to our daughter. You know, she's like family, and there was an immediate connection when, you know, my through Dullboy Pictures, I've got two partners in Gareth and Gavin, who were the first people to invest in My Full Heart. And it was actually Gavin that, through a friend of his, managed to get me and Jane in a room. And it sort of started with his introduction through a mutual friend of theirs. And again, you know, it was that thing of that respect and through that grew, and there were so many people that not just professionally, but since then, have become really good friends through that experience. And I think indirectly, you know, your mentors are, I think the thing I learned, there's a great thing in Goodwill Hunting has always been
you love that movie.
Yeah, I did, for so many reasons, I think. It came out at a time when I started to believe that this was possible. So the story of these two guys kind of believing in themselves and going, we'd rather take less money and be in it because we believe in it. And writing something that they could be in as well, which was, you know, brilliant. And it's just a wonderful move. But for me, to this day, I still stand by this, and I'm yet to see a different interpretation. I think Robin Williams is... portrayal of a therapist and therapy is the most accurate I've ever seen on film or TV, because it's just so honest. It's not as clinical as sometimes people expect. It is creative. It is about relationship. Regardless, you know, I, there's certain ways I don't work in counselling. I tend to work in a more creative and a more relationship-based way. And he just nailed it, because it is unconventional sometimes. You do have to think outside the box. It is about kind of connecting with a client in a way that that allows you to speak the same language and he does that brilliantly. And I think there's that lovely moment in Good Will Hunting when Will is having an argument with this kind of like guy in a cafe who's trying to talk him down a bit. And he starts to recount all the stuff, you know, from this book. And he goes, yeah, I read the same book. And yeah, you know, the ironic thing is, you know, you spent, you know, thousands on an education. I bought that book in for $1.50 or something in the local store, you know. And it's that thing of actually your mentors and your, you know, your inspiration can come from so many forms. And I think growing up, certainly watching movies and not necessarily reading as much, but there's certain things I read that were influential. But music and movies have been massive for me, and storytellers. I mean, I just storytelling, and you know, there's so many filmmakers. But as I think I mentioned earlier, music-wise, you know, Tom Waits, Nick Cave, Neil Young, those types of storytellers, Joni Mitchell. You know, that you hear stories in them, and they're honest, and they're truthful, and they're real, and those are the things that I think have been some of the best mentors, as well as the people physically and more directly. And there's so many people that you respect and admire, and when you meet them, sometimes they live up to that, and sometimes they're very different to, you know, to that. But I think the thing that, you know, there are certain people that I've admired for many years, and you know, before we hit record, I think it was, you know, we talked a little bit about Mark Kermode, and he's been someone I've listened to for years, and I know we have a mutual kind of love of his MK3D show, and that's how kind of we kind of
film club,
and what an incredibly kind, generous man he is, and he was incredibly supportive of our film, and continues to be to this day, even though it's 4 years on, since it had its original release. So I think, you know, listen to someone like that for years, whose opinions you respect and think, and then for them to be so kind about your own thing, that was lovely. But you know, but in some ways that was an educator. The way he thinks about film is very much the way I think about film. I think, you know, I think that's why, as a critic, I find him so, you know, he's a good gauge, and I think someone I've looked up to for many, many years. And so you can be influenced in many, many different ways, you know, through different material. There are people in my everyday life that inspire me, that mentor me. There are, you know, people at college. I mentioned the tutor earlier, but, you know, I started writing for Film Stories magazine, the opening piece I wrote was about him, because he just was so inspiring, and I think he was a massive turning point in my life to start believing that I could do things a different way. It wasn't the conventional way, it was sort of referencing him around Mr. Holland's Opus, a movie that I don't know whether people have seen or not, but it's one of my favourite movies, and it's a Richard Dreyfuss movie, and it's just about a teacher who just puts his time into everybody else eventually, and finds a way that they can play. There's a wonderful moment with him and Alicia Witt, and she's struggling to play the clarinet, and he says to her, and she kind of wants to give up, and he just stops her and he says, you know, tell me one thing you love about yourself. And she says, my hair. My dad says, I love my hair. And he goes, why? And she says, well, because my dad says it's like the sunset. And he just says to her, play the sunset. And he just plays the clarinet beautifully. And that was my tutor. That was this kind of thing he would say and do. And again, he just recognized that it's not always about your technical ability. It's about your belief, you know, and your reason for doing things. And I think that's the thing, is you never lose sight of the reason you're doing it, and you invest in the process. You will achieve. It may sometimes surpass your expectations. It may not sometimes. It doesn't mean it's not invaluable. You know, it's not valuable. You know, firm believer that every experience we have is valuable. There are things in life that I would never want other people to experience, and I wouldn't want to experience myself, but we do. And once they've happened, we have no control over it. It's happened. It's done. It's part of us. It's part of our DNA. What do we do? Do we dwell on it, or do we let it, or do we use it to help us move forward with strength and knowledge? And I think that sometimes, you know, I think I look in terms of mistakes. People often use the word, oh, I made a mistake. I think sometimes we're too quick to label it a mistake. Sometimes it's important to label things as experience, or think of them as a, reframe them as an experience, because for me, a mistake is when we do something and we realize it doesn't work for us, and then we choose to do it again. That's a mistake.
Right.
You know? But if we have an experience, which is the first experience, and we go, that didn't work out, and I could have done it this way. Why didn't I do it this way? But it's okay. Next time I will. That's different. You know, I think sometimes we're too quick to say, oh, I've made a mistake, I got that wrong. You know, so much comes through the things that don't go right. So much learning comes through that. And sometimes we'll get it. It'll be best for us the first time round. Other times it will take us 99 attempts, you know, but we get there. And we only get there because we had those 99. Or 98 before.
I knew I would enjoy having you on the show, because you're like this in real life, and you're very calming and life-affirming and a nice person to be around. But I think the thing that I have taken away from this conversation that I haven't fully understood when we've spoken previously is how, in going after your goals, in going after your dream, it doesn't have to be hard, aggressive, fast, or any of those things. It can be gentle, calm, and nice. Which kind of goes against, you know, those viral videos of all the, you know, people achieving success and that kind of thing. And I that really for me is the thing that is, I mean, every single conversation develops and blossoms in my brain over time, and I take lots of things away from it. But in the first instance, I really feel like that's a real gift that you've given in this, actually, is that it doesn't have to be. And I think sort of the backdrop of the film industry is an interesting one, because you assume that it has to be aggressive and big and loud and brash and what have you, and it doesn't.
Yeah, no, it's lovely to hear that you feel that way, because I think there are certainly the people that I've got to know in this chapter of kind of working in film and such is some of it's above the independent stuff. You know, there are people that you sort of engage with that are working on bigger scales and things, but the independent filmmakers are making some wonderful stuff, and they're really supportive, and there's no jealousy or backbiting in that sense, certainly not in the people that I've gravitated towards. They're really supportive. They're all kind of getting behind each other's projects. You know, with Feral, I'll never forget this. We were fortunate, but you know, our little film that was made for like peanuts compared to some other independent films that were nominated for British Independent Film Awards by a long way. You know, Stephen was up there, Shana was up there being nominated up against Michael Fassbender and, you know, Shia LaBeouf and, you know, people like that. And, you know, were nominated, you know, alongside films like Daniel Blake and American Honey. And, you know, there are all these people there, and we made this film like just through genuine kind of passion. A lot of other filmmakers there are doing the same. But I'll never forget that a film that had a similar sort of journey to ours at the same time, went to similar festivals, similar awards, made it the similar way, was Adult Life Skills by Rachel Tunnard and Jodie Whittaker. It's a lovely film. I love it. And I'd recommend it to anyone. And I'll never forget, like, the cheers when their films came up for different awards. We were nominated for different things. But the cheers from their table and for when our film came out, and vice versa. And I'll never forget that. I do believe that there is, I mean, I'm, you know, sometimes it might seem optimistic or you know, dreamlike, but I think I've become more realistic as I've got older, but I still err on the side of positivity and optimism. And I do generally believe that I don't believe people are born bad. I don't believe in that idea of a bad seed. You know, I believe that there are people who are born with a more natural tendency to be empathic, absolutely. But I think that nature and nurture plays a part. It's not just about one or the other. And I think that, and people do have an incredible capacity to change. And I think given the right environment, given the right support, people can. And I've seen it firsthand. And, you know, I've seen remarkable change in people. And, you know, I think it would be sad to live in a world where we think that change isn't possible. And that we as individuals don't have the ability to change. And I think naturally at the moment we're all being tested, and we're all finding something out about ourselves, the people around us, and the universe. And my sincere hope that comes out of this situation that we're all in at the moment is that when this is all over, you know, when we get to a point where we have a new normal, as we're hearing quite a lot, and it will be, I think, is that we will be able to move forward in a different way, in a way that is more supportive of others, for those that are more secure and safe and stable at the moment. We can all reach out to somebody else at this time and beyond that is less fortunate and is maybe more vulnerable. And if we can all do that, then we're going to cover all bases, and it will make a difference. And that's my hope for this situation. It really is, because, and I think we're seeing more of that than we are the negative. But
yeah,
the negative, sadly, is like a poison, and it does find its way to the surface, and it gets a lot of exposure. It's really important that we don't invite that in.
Mm.
You know, that again, we make a choice as to what we invite into our lives. We limit the negativity. Doesn't mean we don't listen to it and acknowledge it, but we don't have to. I think we mentioned earlier, we said, I think the analogy was something like, you know, if it comes knocking on the door, you know, we don't have to invite it in for a cuppa. You know? We can put the door locked, or we can peer through the window or say, not today, thank you. And I think it's really important that we allow ourselves sometimes. There are times when it's okay for us to say no to things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are times when it's important we say yes to those things as well. We can learn a lot from that, I think.
Oh, Duncan, this has been so, so wonderful. I've loved having you on the show.
Thank you. It's been lovely being on.
It's such good vibes. Well, you always do. And one day we will get to go to film club again. But I hope you appreciated getting to tap into Duncan's wisdom and also his story, which is incredible, doing what you wanted to do, set out to do, but on your terms in a way that makes you happy, which is just so inspiring, I think. And obviously the links to Duncan, My Feral Heart, everything that we discussed will be in the show notes. But Duncan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely. Thank you.
I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. I think the thing I really took away from that chat was how it doesn't have to be that hard and fast pursuit of a dream. It can be gentle, it can be kind, it can be calm. I think we've got this idea in our head, or we get projected this idea in media everywhere, that if you want to follow your dream, you've got to be all in, and it's got to be at 100, or, you know, pedal to the metal all the time. And Duncan, I think, is just a really good example of someone who's just very calmly, methodically and gently gone towards what he wanted and achieved it, and hasn't had to, you know, be saying all those big bright things that you hear people say on The Apprentice, you know, all those big sort of bold claims of I'm gonna do it. You don't have to be like that about it. You can still be calm and still get where you want to be, which I think is the thing I really, really came away from this conversation with. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to get in touch with me about this episode or any other, why don't you email me, thebeautypodcast@gmail.com, or you can slide into my DMs on Instagram and Twitter, where I'm at Emma Guns. I would love to hear from you. If you want to chat about this episode with me and thousands of other listeners of this show, then why don't you go to the Facebook group? The link to join is in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you spending it with me. And I cannot wait to see you on the next one.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.